Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today, we'll discuss the Guidelines in Cardiovascular Physiology review article by Heart et al. Titled, Recording Sympathetic Nerve Activity in Conscious Humans and Other Mammals, Guidelines and the Road to Standardization. This article was accepted for publication on March 6, 2017. Joining me today are Editor-in-Chief Irv Zucker and lead authors Nisha Charkoudian, Jason Carter, Jeff Head, and John Osborne. Let's get started.
Thank you, Kara. I'm Irv Zucker, Editor-in-Chief of AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I will moderate this special podcast associated with the publication of our first guidelines paper. One, I hope there will be many more. This paper focuses on technical and analytical aspects of recording sympathetic nerve activity in humans and animals. I'm extremely pleased to be joined today by several co-authors of this paper who are among the most qualified individuals to discuss this topic. Nisha, Jason, Jeff, and John, thanks very much for participating in this podcast today. Unfortunately, several other co-authors are not able to join us today, and they should be acknowledged. Emma Hart of the University of Bristol is the lead author of this paper, and Gunnar Wallin from the University of Gothenburg, Clive May of the Florey Institute in Melbourne, Australia, Shireen Hamza of the University of Alberta, and John Hall of the University of Mississippi Medical Center have all done a fantastic job. It's been incredible how you all pulled this together and provided your collective expertise to come to a consensus on this guidelines paper. This was a real tour de force, and our listeners should know that this endeavor was well over a year in the making. So I congratulate all of you and give special credit to Emma Hart for coordinating everything and doing much of the writing and editing. I know this will be of great benefit to the autonomic and the cardiovascular community in general. So for those listeners who are devotees of our podcast, I just want to preface our discussion by saying that this will be quite a difference from our usual 10 to 12 minute podcasts. The guidelines papers are meant to help investigators with a variety of technical and methodological aspects in a given field. This podcast will be substantially longer than our normal podcasts and is meant to complement the manuscript where you can find all of the pertinent references and, of course, the figures. So with that introduction, let's get started. I'd first like to turn our attention to the area of human microneurography. Jason and Nisha, you've both had a good deal of experience with this technique, which takes a good deal of skill. I'd like you both to discuss several issues related to this technique, especially what investigators need to consider when setting up a microneurographic laboratory. Importantly, what are the main validation techniques and the pitfalls to be aware of when recording both multi-unit and single-unit activity? If both of you could briefly discuss also the analytical techniques used to quantify nerve activity, including issues related to between individual and within individual analyses, that would be very helpful. So Jason, can you start us off with some commentary on the technique itself?
Sure. Thanks, Irv. And let me start by congratulating and thanking my colleagues on this paper, particularly Emma, threading together this type of guidelines paper that incorporates five different species was no easy feat. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the microneurography technique, which was introduced by Valbo and Hagbarth in 1967. Coincidentally, your sister APS journal, the Journal of Neurophysiology, has an ongoing call in this area for any listeners interested in that particular subject. To your question, Irv, this guidelines paper outlines a number of important steps in not only setting up a microneurography lab, but also, and very importantly, securing and analyzing high-quality recordings. Perhaps the most important recommendation is our resounding endorsement of a concept Duane Ekberg first published in the late 1980s, and that is for extensive training from an independent and highly skilled microneurographer for a minimum of at least 1 year, preferably more. This recommendation is not only to ensure subject safety, but also to ensure that many procedural and analytical caveats and pitfalls are adequately experienced and understood by the trainees. So, for example, I have come across neurograms presented at various conferences and journals over the years that make me sometimes question if the illustrated muscle sympathetic nerve activity, or what we commonly refer to in this paper as MSNA, had any underlying skin sympathetic nerve activity, commonly referred to as SSNA. Anatomically, the skin and the muscle nerve fascicles are in very close proximity to one another, and fibers from one type can sometimes cross over into another in a recording. We often refer to these as combo nerves, and this can and should be avoided, since having both signals concurrently can significantly interfere not only with burst detection, but also the quantification as well as mechanistic interpretations. To an untrained and underexperienced microneurographer, it can sometimes be very difficult to notice these differences. That said, there are a number of safeguards against this that we clearly outline in this guidelines paper, specifically attention to burst morphology as well as the responses to brief auditory and respiratory maneuvers are an absolute must for any microneurographer. When it comes to integrated MSNA, the burst morphology is very sharp and distinct and is pulse synchronized, in which the burst occurs about 1.3 seconds after an R wave. MSNA burst conformation should include a brief voluntary and expiratory apnea, which elicits a very distinct rise in the MSNA. In contrast, the MSNA skin sympathetic nerve activity is not pulse synchronized, and the burst morphology is longer and broader and tends to be more shallow. And while MSNA will not respond to a sudden auditory stimulation, such as a loud yell or a clap, skin sympathetic activity will. And figure two in this guidelines paper illustrates that. You can see in figure two that there are times also when the skin nerve has a much more sharp and distinct shape, making it appear like an MSNA recording. And this is why it's so crucial to do some of those auditory and respiratory stimulations. So this obviously takes a lot of training, a lot of experience. It can be very difficult to locate quality neurograms. And there is certainly an art to it, as I know there is to all of these recordings across all the species we covered in this paper. Lastly, and because I know Nisha is going to follow up with some comments on the analytical caveats, including minimum signal-to-noise ratio, I cannot underscore enough the importance of being somewhat picky when it comes to the recording. There is absolutely no substitute for a high-quality neurogram that reveals signal-to-noise ratio much larger than the minimum 3-to-1 recommended ratio. We can often get greater than 10-to-1 ratios for some of our large bursts. And obtaining such clean signals is, again, somewhat of an art, somewhat luck, but ultimately needs to be balanced with recommended maximum search times as well of about 45 to 60 minutes.
Jason, clearly this is quite an art form. Nisha, can you expand on what Jason has said and maybe talk a little bit about how one can quantify burst activity and maybe even discuss a little bit about single unit activity?
Yes, thanks, Irv. And I'm delighted to be a participant in this podcast as well as in the manuscript itself. I thought I'd step back for just a minute for those listeners who might not be as familiar with microneurography and just make a few comments about the nerve signals that we're able to measure in humans, because this relates directly to why you would analyze an MSNA signal, for example, in a certain way. So when we can measure sympathetic nerve activity in humans, the two main things we can measure, as Jason mentioned, are muscle sympathetic nerve activity and skin sympathetic nerve activity. One of the reasons that you see muscle sympathetic nerve activity measured more commonly, especially as it relates to cardiovascular regulation or blood pressure control, is that muscle sympathetic nerves, as we record them in humans, are only vasoconstrictor in nature. So those are noradrenergic nerves that are causing vasoconstriction when they're activated. When you measure skin sympathetic nerve activity, you're measuring a nerve that could have any one or all of four different nerve types: vasoconstrictor, vasodilator, pseudomotor, and pilomotor, which makes analysis and interpretation a lot more difficult. I'd like to agree. I meant to start out by agreeing with everything that Jason said. I think he raised very important points about getting a lab set up, about learning how to do microneurography and interpreting the signal that you might get, and really the very, very strong importance of having a quality neurogram signal. As we stated in the paper, we recommend a minimum of 3-to-1 ratio of signal to noise. And really, if you can do better than that, it makes your life a lot easier in terms of interpreting your data.
When one reads papers with MSNA measured, or even skin nerve activity, we see integrated bursting activity, and people quantify this in different ways: burst frequency, burst incidence. Can you comment on which is preferred, or are there differences in when one analyzes the data in these various ways?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Irv. So the two most common ways that you'll see sympathetic nerve activity, muscle sympathetic nerve activity expressed is either as burst frequency, which is bursts per minute, or burst incidence, which is bursts per 100 heartbeats. Because of the very tight relationship between muscle sympathetic nerve activity and the arterial baroreflex, each burst, as Jason mentioned earlier, is very tightly linked to the cardiac cycle. And this is because there's essentially a mini baroreflex loop that occurs within each cardiac cycle that includes a burst. So each upswing of the MSNA burst is a disinhibition of sympathetic nerve activity, and each peak or and downstroke of the burst is actually an inhibition that comes from the subsequent systole of that cardiac cycle. So because of that, in each cardiac cycle in humans, you have the opportunity for either one burst or zero bursts. So if you increase the number of cardiac cycles, that is, you increase heart rate, you have more opportunities for bursts in a, in a given minute. So therefore, in some situations, depending on the research question, if people are interested in the neurophysiological control of the output of muscle sympathetic nerve activity, it's sometimes of more interest to measure the number of bursts as related to heart rate, which is this index that we use of burst incidence or bursts per 100 heartbeats. In some cases, it's of more interest to look at that index. And in other cases, it's of more interest to look at burst frequency, which is the total number of bursts in a given minute. The way I think about it sometimes is that the burst frequency is sometimes more helpful when you're interested in something that has to do with overall quantitatively looking at blood pressure regulation, because the burst frequency is more closely related to how much norepinephrine do the blood vessels really see in a minute. But if you're interested in more in something that has to do with gating of sympathetic nerve activity, or something that maybe is also related to blood pressure regulation but has to do with controlling for large differences in heart rate, for example, in different patient populations that might have different resting heart rates, in those cases, it might be more appropriate to look at bursts per 100 heartbeats, which actually brings me to another very important point related to quantification and analysis of muscle sympathetic nerve activity. If you look at a neurogram, you'll always see, no matter how good the quality is of the neurogram, you'll always see bursts of different sizes. Now, for that reason, it's often tempting to look at the size of the burst or the amplitude of the burst or the area under the curve of the burst, which we call total activity of sympathetic nerve activity, and to do analysis on that total activity. And that would take into account both the number and size of the bursts, and you could quantify that over a given period of time, say a minute or 5 minutes or whatever. Because of the way that we do microneurography in humans, it's extremely important that the only time anyone ever uses that total activity analysis is if it's in the same person with the same electrode that hasn't moved during the entire time that any perturbation might be done. So for example, if you're looking at one person and then you tilt that person and then you tilt them again and then you have them do an apnea, it's appropriate to look at total activity for those interventions in that person and compare them. If you're looking at two different groups of people or the same person on different days where you don't know where the electrode is relative to the nerve in each of those groups of people or in each of those study days, it is not appropriate, and we've emphasized this in the paper as well, to compare groups or different study days using total activity. In those cases, it's most appropriate to either use bursts per minute or bursts per 100 heartbeats. Jason, did you want to add anything to that commentary?
Yeah, well, I'll just comment on that. I do think that that's a very important point that Nish just brought up. The one time when there is some agreement that total MSNA can be used across days or whatever is, and where we've seen some reproducibility, is if you're looking at changes. If you have a very strong normalization procedure.
Oh, sorry, right. I should have clarified.
Yeah. If we have a strong normalization procedure during the baseline, and then we're comparing the changes, and it can matter whether you're looking at absolute changes or percent changes, but either way, it's very important that the only time you ever look at total MSNA across days in individuals or across groups is if you're comparing the changes to an intervention like a tilt or a stress task or whatever, and then looking at them. But it's highly inappropriate to look at total MSNA across baselines, and yet it still occurs.
Yeah, this is a great discussion. John or Jeff, anything you want to add, even though you may not do human microneurography yourself, you want to make any comments?
This is Jeff Head. I had a question as to whether you listen to the neurogram to make sure that it's got the right audio quality. This is something we do in animals, and I was wondering whether you do that in humans.
I'm sure Nisha does too. We have audio with it, and you definitely have a distinct sound, not only at the insertion point, but then as it's bursting. And that's another one of the ways you can differentiate between a muscle and a skin. It's not that the sounds are different, but it's the more shallow and broad types of strokes. But you definitely hear it, and we do use audio. Audio is more for the search process than anything else from my perspective. Nisha, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I would agree with that, Jason. I think it's primarily for the search process. I think there's some correlation, and just anecdotally in my experience, between having a good sound quality and having a good neurogram, a good nerve signal. I don't know that we tend to use it as anything more than that, though.
So let me ask another question. There are two things that maybe our listeners would be interested in. One is the correlation between muscle sympathetic nerve activity in terms of bursts or absolute activity and norepinephrine spillover. It's still not 100% clear by anybody how a given action potential or a burst translates into the quantal release of neurotransmitter. Can either of you or anyone comment on the relationship? I know there have been studies done in this regard. Nisha?
I have a few thoughts that came to mind, and then Jason, you can take it from there. So the first studies that come to my mind when you mention that are the studies that Gunnar Wallin did with Murray Esler in the late 80s and mid 90s, looking at that exact question. So actually using the norepinephrine spillover technique and trying to quantify what relationships there were between muscle sympathetic nerve activity measured with microneurography and other norepinephrine spillover measurements of sympathetic nerve activity to the kidney, to the heart, and then whole body norepinephrine spillover representing whole body resting sympathetic outflow. And what they found was that there were strong relationships. There were positive, significantly positive correlations between the muscle sympathetic nerve activity and all of those variables. So cardiac norepinephrine spillover, renal norepinephrine spillover, and whole body norepinephrine spillover. Now, there are a few caveats to that. One is that, as you know, norepinephrine spillover does not have the temporal resolution that microneurography has. And I know that people have been looking into more specifically how blood flow and blood pressure change on more of a beat-by-beat fashion. I think Jason can comment a little bit more on that with a particular burst or a particular series of bursts. I know, and of course, with just resting plasma values of norepinephrine, the correlation isn't always there. It's usually there, but not always. And then again, that has to do with norepinephrine release, reuptake, and metabolism that all can affect the level of norepinephrine circulating at any given time. Jason?
I think you hit all the major points, Nisha. I mean, the norepinephrine spillover technique is so cost prohibitive and only done by a handful of individuals. There hasn't been enough research in this particular area. The original studies done by Gunnar and Murray are still the only ones out there really that have investigated this. So it's a tough question to ask. And I think, you know, the best we can say is that there's correlation, but as we all know, the sympathetic nervous system is highly regionalized. And so we're always very careful in making sure we try not to overstretch beyond the vascular beds and areas that we're exactly looking at directly with the microneurographic procedure.
Right. And sorry, I just wanted to add to that. When they did those studies that Murray and Gunnar did, they were only at rest in young men. So that did not involve any kind of perturbation, any kind of stimulus or anything. So that was just resting values.
Good point.
This is Jeff Head. There was a study from Barry McGrath and Pat Dord many years ago that looked at renal sympathetic activity in rabbits and renal spillover. And so it was the sympathetic spillover and the nerve recording in the same bed, which I think is very important. And they showed a very strong correlation between those two.
Yes, that's true. I remember that paper very well. So can you say a little bit about single unit recording? We haven't really discussed that yet. And I know this has been something that's been of interest to a lot of people, especially in the last five or so years. Jason, Nisha, you want to comment?
This is where I wish we had Gunnar here, but I can take a stab, and between the two of us, maybe you'll get something useful out of it. So the difference between the multi-fiber and single unit recordings is that with the single unit recordings, we're using higher impedance electrodes. You got to be careful that you're not too selective with those electrodes, because then you can have some practical disadvantages where it's difficult to find the active fibers. And there haven't been a lot of studies that have actually been conducted to evaluate the optimal electrodes. electrode impedance for these single unit recordings or not. But essentially, in a given electrode site, all action potentials generated by a single nerve fiber have an identical waveform, usually triphasic with a large negative component for the vasomotor, but sometimes biphasic. And the hallmark, though, of a successful single unit recording is inspection of these individual spikes. And what the investigators are doing is superimposing all of the spikes in question to demonstrate a waveform similarity. Occasionally, activity is more than one single fiber, and it can be identified within the same electrode site. So it is a more of a boutique type of recording. There are pros and there are cons to it. There's more and more people that are utilizing this, and it does, in contrast to the traditional integrated MSNA and SSNA signals, it requires the raw signal, much like is what is done in many of the animal recordings.
Right. Nisha, anything to add?
No, I think Jason did a great job. I was just smiling when you said the boutique. I think everything we do in this whole call is a boutique recording. But no, I agree. And I think getting back to just the types of questions, I think the questions that have to do with the single unit approach, it gives you less information than what's traditionally done with human MSNA in terms of blood pressure regulation as a whole. It's a little bit more specifically neurophysiological, at least the way I think about it.
Great. So let's turn our attention now to animal recordings. John, you've, among your many areas of expertise, you've made a reputation in defining specific sympathetic signatures in experimental animals, mostly rodents. I wonder if you could start the discussion by talking a little bit about the do's and don'ts of recording from conscious animals, in addition to the pure surgical technique that one needs, and how to avoid getting artifactual data.
Sure. Well, first, it's been great to be a part of this paper and part of the podcast. Mm. So, and also I want to acknowledge that the work that I've done in this field was really made possible through a collaboration with Drs. Kenju Miki and Misa Yashimoto in Japan. They pioneered a lot of the work in terms of the rat work and published some fine papers, which are referenced in the paper. The thing with rats, unlike humans, is we can record from several different nerves with chronically implanted electrodes, primarily the renal nerve and the lumbar and the greater splanchnic nerves. Now, typically, the renal has been used most, I think partly because it's technically easier in terms of the electrode placement and recording. And the splanchnic is a bit more challenging because we tend to get respiratory artifact, which is tough to deal with. So renal has been used quite a bit. Like with the human work that Jason and Nisha was talking about, I'd say the single greatest requirement for long-term nerve recordings is the skill of the surgeon. And this has to be understood by anybody who's going to get into this. Unlike the radio telemetry devices for recording blood pressure now, has made it possible for a lot of laboratories to do conscious blood pressure recordings, and many institutions even have core labs that do that. The success for sympathetic nerve recordings in conscious animals is entirely dependent on a highly skilled, experienced surgeon. So it really won't matter whether you're using wireless implantable electrodes like from Data Sciences, or the more traditional method of exteriorizing the leads to an external amplifier. The surgeon is the key. When I started working with Kenju, he made it a very clear requirement. You just need a very high quality surgical microscope. Being able to see what you're doing is very important. And as much as possible, the surgeon's got to use extreme caution to isolate the nerve bundle without actually touching it or stretching it or doing much of anything to it as you isolate it to try to get it on your electrode. And then once the nerve is isolated, typically you place it on a bipolar hook electrode, stainless steel. It can be other types of metal too, but stainless steel is pretty typical. And the key is to also, with these small nerves, is to not damage the blood supply to the nerve, which is difficult, but it's something you have to be very aware of. And then the nerve is encased in a silicone solution to basically seal it from the surrounding fluid, and a ground lead is put in. The details for this are covered in the paper, but I'd refer the readers to papers by Miki and also Stocker and Munsell, in which these are covered in quite a bit of detail. Now, in terms of longevity of the recording, it's possible to get recordings that will last for weeks. We have one paper in which we recorded for 4 weeks, but that's extremely difficult to do. And I would say with a skilled surgeon who's experienced using the techniques outlined in the paper, you can get recordings on the order of several days to a couple of weeks in the rat, so that your experiments really need to fit within in that time frame. And finally, I'd comment on two other challenging aspects of doing nerve recordings in conscious animals beyond just getting the electrodes in and getting signals. And this relates to what we've been talking about in humans, and that's the issue of how do you quantify the nerve signal. Jeff has published some nice papers on this. Maybe he'll speak to this in more detail. But, you know, the issue is that the total voltage is dependent on several factors that you really can't control between subjects, including how many fibers are in the nerve bundle that you're recording from, the spatial orientation to the electrode of the axons, things like that. So the big issue is in the field is how do you statistically compare nerve activity between subjects. So we either normalize the signal as a percent of baseline, maybe for acute responses, or to a stimulus that invokes some maximal sympathetic response, typically with the nasopharyngeal reflex, with cigarette smoke or something like that. But at the present time, this is certainly the big question in the field, is there's no single way of quantifying the activity that is perfect under all conditions. And so that's, we go back and forth on the best way to do that.
Right.
Just one last point is that the final issue really relates to the physiology at hand, which is something we talk about a lot. So that is, what nerve are you going to record from? You have the option in the rat of renal or lumbar or splanchnic. Well, renal is used a lot because I do think it's easier. And in the world of hypertension, there's a lot of emphasis on neural control of the kidney. But now we know sympathetic activity to other vascular beds is obviously important as well. So to the question about which nerve do you record from and are they different, the answer is, yeah, they're all different and they probably respond differently. So the idea of sympathetic signatures, you know, is important, that you need to pick the right nerve for the question that you're going after. And we still have a lot of work to do with figuring out exactly what nerves to record from.
Right. Jeff, you want to expand on anything that John has said and maybe talk a little bit about your experience with larger animals?
Yes, thanks, Irv. It's terrific to be part of this, and it's been a wonderful process, albeit rather long. But I'd just like to emphasize a couple of the points that people have made. And our expertise is really with long-term recording in rabbits. And I have to acknowledge the pioneering work of the late Pat Dorward, who developed this technique in the 1980s at the Baker here, and Sandra Burke, who's been implanting renal electrodes for 35 years and has, I think, got the world record in both the number and the quality of her recordings. So she's really the expert in the area. One of the things that's clearly very important that John mentioned was the delicate handling of the nerve bundle itself. And in the rabbit, anatomically, it's rather more simple in that it runs pretty much along the artery between the vein, and sometimes in one or two bundles. And the electrode is sewn to the renal artery with some very delicate sutures through the wall of the artery. And that technique allowed the movement of the electrode with the artery and kidney so that the nerve was relatively protected. The most important thing, as John mentioned, was to make sure the blood supply, particularly the venous return, which is most easily compressed, is intact. So that's the main thing. And one of the ways of doing this in the rabbit is to isolate a very long length of the nerve so that it very gradually leaves the artery, goes up to the two spiral arms of the electrode and then down again, and that's embedded in the Wacker Sil gel. It's important to use the minimum amount of gel as possible. And also we've found that the surgery should be done fairly quickly. Within 90 minutes is ideal. So this does require skill and training. And it usually takes about 6 months for someone to become really proficient at doing this and getting the high success rates. A couple of other aspects are the having a good amplifier, a low noise amplifier, and we've got currently shielded rooms, which eliminate peripheral noise and signals, which has been invaluable. We've tried recording in some rooms that don't have shielding, and that's proved to be very difficult. Moving on to quantification, John mentioned the nasopharyngeal reflex, which in the rabbit works very, very well. And we've spent quite some time in trying to validate that as a method. And we've most recently compared the nasopharyngeal technique with the method developed by Gunnar Wallin in humans, where he measured the peak height or area under the maximum burst in the baseline technique. And that actually works really well in eliminating the differences between the recording conditions. So the biggest influence on the microvolts you get is the proximity of the electrode with the nerves. And in the case of humans, it's also with the tip of the micro electrode with the bundle and what it's picking up. And to normalize that is actually quite effective using the maximum burst. But the comparison between groups that we tested was only found using the nasopharyngeal reflex. So we compared a number of different conditions, and that was really necessary. But as someone has pointed out every time we publish this, we can't absolutely be sure that the nasopharyngeal reflex is truly independent, although we believe it is. There's no absolute proof of that.
This is sort of equivalent to the cold presser test in humans, I guess, where you get a non-baroreflex mediated increase in sympathetic nerve activity. I think Nisha and Jason both use that technique quite a bit, correct?
Yes. And actually, when I was referring to the strong reproducibility that we see with microneurography, whether it be day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year, it's not only during baseline, but we've shown very recently that that reproducibility is present during a lot of those different types of acute laboratory stressors, such as the cold pressor test.
So, Jeff, could you comment at all about the sheep model that Clive has really pioneered and published quite a bit on?
Well, Clive has done really remarkably well in being able to record cardiac sympathetic activity as well as renal in the conscious sheep. And one of the advantages of the sheep is that it's a rather large animal. It's very placid in that it stands in the cage during the experiments. And one of the advantages of the rabbit is that it sits in the box very quietly. It likes actually being in the box. And we've compared the recordings from the laboratory to the home cage in the rabbit and found that the level of nerve activity is identical, as is the blood pressure. With the technique in the sheep, one of the differences is they use sharpened insect pins that are insulated, and they slide the electrode into the nerve bundle, and then they embed that in the gels. So rather than the electrode being a spiral in the case of the rabbit and a hook in the case of rat, the sheep is different in that it's large enough to put the electrode inside the bundle. This would be, I think, ideal, because what eventually stops the recording, in the rabbits at least, is a growth of connective tissue around the interface between the nerve bundle and the electrode. So this would be less problematic, I'd imagine, in the sheep when the electrode's inside the bundle. I don't know if John's got a comment on that.
The only thing I would add is it's a great advantage when you said they can record from cardiac and renal. That's simultaneously in the same animal, which is a great advantage of the sheep. And they've done some beautiful work looking at differential control of sympathetic activity with that model.
So maybe you both can comment a little bit about movement artifact in conscious animals. Do you inspect the record and remove what you think are movement artifacts, or how do you regulate that? And even in the best of situations, animals move and wires move and et cetera. Anyone can jump in. John, Jeff.
So with renal recordings, that's rarely an issue. Lumbar, you can pick up a bit of movement artifact, and you do basically need to visually look at the tracings, and it's somewhat subjective, but there's times where you can pick up, you see movement artifact, and we simply don't analyze that part of the recording.
Right.
And as I said earlier, with splanchnic, which we've tried, the splanchnic nerve is difficult to get clean signals, and we pick up respiratory artifact from the diaphragm. And so that's been the most challenging one for us to deal with.
Jeff, what about the rabbits?
The rabbit will sit quietly in the box, but occasionally it decides that it would like to turn around, or it shakes its head or moves and readjusts itself. And those cause huge spikes in the recording. And we generally mark those and cut them out of the recording so they're not part of it. So that's the visual inspection of the recording and marking those times when the animal is moving is very important to eliminate that. The other area we could probably talk about is just removing what would be the background noise level from the signal. In the humans, the acceptable level is 3:1 for signal to noise. I think you can see from the figures in the paper that the rabbit is quite often a very much higher signal to noise ratio. I think you can see that the bursts are often 300 or 400 microvolts and noise around about 7. So it's a lot easier. There are various techniques that we mentioned in the paper, and perhaps we could talk about this with other species. The simple interburst period when the nerve is relatively silent is one. Using a ganglion blockade either at the end of the experiment is another method. I think that's used in rats, and perhaps John could comment. The gap between the nasopharyngeal reflex burst responses is also used. And our software does a running estimate of the noise in between the bursts and eliminates that for us automatically. But we can go back after determining the noise and subtract it from the signal. And that's a very important part, particularly when the recordings are becoming less robust and more noisy as they occurs over several weeks. Right. Perhaps John?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And with the rats, actually, that's we've done the same in terms of just getting the interburst silent periods and using that as our noise level, and confirmed that with ganglionic blockade that that's accurate. So it's kind of a moving measurement of the noise signal that we analyze the data with.
So I don't know if anybody wants to comment on mouse recordings. This seems like a real challenge. Has either of you had any experience or want to comment about the difficulties in doing this?
We haven't. We've done some recordings of sympathetic activity in anesthetized mice. Yes, they're harder. Yeah. And even with the paper that they published in mice, I mean, there's that one paper. But doing recordings over longer periods of time is going to be difficult. And I think it's important to point out, it's great to have a recording in an awake animal, but if it's an awake animal that's stressed because it's been too soon since surgery, that's not necessarily ideal. So I think it's critical to get past the recovery stage. And in rats, we wait until 3 or 4 or 5 days after surgery before we actually start to quantify the activity. So I do think in mice, you can get a recording in a conscious mouse, but longer-term recordings are going to be very difficult.
Jeff, any comments about that?
Yes. Once again, minimum 5 days post-recovery before we begin experiments. That's critical because there is a very much a strong sympathetic activation post-surgery. And I think this is one of the challenges. The mice, we've done some preliminary recordings in mice, and it is under anesthesia, as John said, it is very difficult. The nerve is really quite difficult to isolate clearly. So that's been a tour de force to publish that paper in mice, but I don't expect we'll see a flurry of subsequent papers in the species. One other comment I'll make just on the rabbits is quite often after some recovery, an animal, you connect it up and there's almost no nerve activity. And it's been, particularly with new people who are new with the recording, thinking they've got an electrode that hasn't worked. But often the resting activity is quite low in a conscious, fully recovered animal. And that if you do a stimulus, a noise or something else, you'll see big bursts of activity. So sometimes low activity isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's actually right. what the physiology right. is. Right.
And
is
it's certainly saying. Certainly species dependent, I think.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. Well, listen, we're going to bring this discussion to a close. I want to thank all of you for your participation. This has been a really great discussion. It's something that we will be talking about for years to come, I'm sure, at many conferences and meetings. And this will be very helpful to our listeners and the readers of AJP Heart and Circ. So I'm going to turn it back to you, Kara.
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology podcast. For more podcasts like this, visit us online at ajpheart.physiology.org. Thank you.